You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that discusses developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. LawPod UK is produced by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row and is presented by Rosalind English.
Today, I will be talking to Katrina Murdoch, a barrister at 1 Crown Office Row, who's currently in The Hague. Katrina has practiced in international criminal law for over 9 years, advising on crimes arising out of the genocide in Rwanda, the Iraq War, the current conflicts in the Yemen, and the war in the former Yugoslavia. Katrina, many thanks for coming on the podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Could you explain how you came to be doing this work with global rights compliance?
Yes, sure. Well, I moved over to The Hague nearly 3 years ago now, actually, and I started on the retrial of Stanisic and Samatovic at the International Criminal Tribunal here. And the lead counsel on that case is the managing partner of Global Rights Compliance. So I was aware of the work that they were doing as I started the trial. And then it was very much a sort of open door in terms of projects that they were interested in. And so it really developed from there.
So could you tell us a little bit more about the Global Rights Compliance Foundation?
Yes, so Global Rights Compliance was set up 5 years ago now, actually, and it came out of the end of the first trial of the end of Samatovic and Stanisic when they were acquitted. Both accused are Serbian and Belgrade Serbs, and Stanisic was the former head of the State Security Service, and Samatovic is his co-accused. So Global Rights Compliance, it emerged at the end of that first trial as a sort of way to move away from some of these slightly monolithic institutions where justice is very slow and political and often quite removed from the situation on the ground. So the projects at that point started in Ukraine, with capacity building and reforming their national institutions, legal institutions, and training with judges, prosecutors, and a raft of different legal actors. And also a big project in Bangladesh to do with business and human rights, which has subsequently developed into a modern slavery program. So it's grown from quite a small startup to a really niche organization, actually, with a lot of very interesting international lawyers, a lot of brilliant women who are leading the projects, and it's a really creative and collaborative work environment, really.
So let's move on to the specific project that you're working on. It's to do with accountability for starvation. Is that correct?
The mass starvation project has been, it's been going now for sort of approaching 2 years. And it started actually when I was reading an article in the London Review of Books by Alex Duvall, who we subsequently now partner with. And it was a really provocative title called "The Nazis Used It," and it was about the reemergence of famine. So it was a really interesting way at looking at this crime and a very sort of interesting angle, really, about how starvation is used and tolerated in conflict and the way that famines are now re-emerging. I mean, certainly in my lifetime, it's only in the last year or so that we've seen some of these emerging in the likes of Syria, South Sudan, Somalia, and Yemen, of course.
How do warring parties actually inflict famine on communities?
There's a wide variety of ways that food and food insecurity is exacerbated, and the word that's being used in by certain sort of UN statements is weaponized. The obvious places that you see it are in detention facilities, and we saw adjudication of that throughout the Yugoslavia tribunal, where those in detention camps were given starvation rations, and that's quite a simple case. You know, in those examples, it's quite simple. I think where it becomes more complicated, and current examples are, you know, a range of things from international humanitarian law access violations. So where you have warring parties who are deliberately obstructing aid or diverting aid or destroying aid is one way, and we see that in a multitude of conflicts that are currently happening. And then we have economic policies of the likes that we're seeing in Yemen, where, for example, salaries are being withheld. People have no purchasing power with which to buy food, leading to malnutrition and starvation. And then we have broader policies such as, or tactics such as siege warfare and naval blockades. Again, Syria, in eastern Ghouta, where we had the siege there, where aid was entirely obstructed from coming into that pocket. And then the likes of blockades across Yemen, where imports are being delayed and aid is perishing on the shores, to more obvious attacks, again, which are Yemen-based, with agricultural infrastructure being directly targeted with airstrikes.
And in all of this, apart from the detention centre example, where you can identify the villain, as it were, what can your organisation do about it?
Well, we're at the very early stages, and the project that we have really, it's got three main aims. So analysis, advocacy, and accountability. And we are some way from the accountability output. Now, at the start of, in May of this year, our donors, the Netherlands Ministry of Foreign Affairs, they were the pen holders in a really instrumental resolution, UN Security Council Resolution 2417. And that was a real, as I say, a landmark step towards labelling starvation as a war crime in both non-international armed conflicts and international armed conflicts. And what we're seeking to do through this project is really understand how it has been used historically, how starvation has been used as a war crime or as a different forms of crimes, be it crimes against humanity or violations of international humanitarian law, and then really work out how individual responsibility has been wrestled with in those examples and why prosecutions haven't been forthcoming. And then the advocacy component is really, you know, talking to official mechanisms, to individuals, investigators, victims, journalists, and a wide range of actors from the Food and Agricultural Organization, UN institutions, the World Food Programme and the like. And then that, at the end of those two projects or components of the project, we would start to look at accountability. And I think as with a lot of international criminal work and trials and crimes such as starvation, there's rarely a smoking gun. You know, there's a long lead time of investigation and analysis, and then building brick by brick a case, really. And I think that will be the next step for us in terms of looking once we've done those initial steps.
So let me see if I understand this UN Security Council Resolution 2417. Does that of itself provide a legal basis for some future prosecution?
No. So what it does is it was rare in the sense that thematic resolutions at the Security Council are less popular. They tend to be rooted in country-specific resolutions and usually sanctions flowing from those, or often sanctions flowing. So this was a thematic resolution that discussed the use of starvation as a war crime in both armed conflicts and non-international armed conflicts. And what it did is it acknowledged that prosecutions at an international level have made inroads and steps towards ending impunity. And it further encouraged robust and independent investigations and possible accountability options, both on a national level and on an international level, was one of its outcomes. And one of the other important outcomes of it was its reporting function. So the reports on starvation will now be produced to the Security Council and the Secretary General himself. So this issue remains at a high level debate.
I see. So it's not so much about a future prosecution or bringing future prosecutions. It's more about forcing this theme into the high level of UN debates. And how do you think that that level of debate is going to affect the situation for the people who are actually suffering in conflict zones?
Well, I think, I mean, it's, you know, the Security Council is, as with all of these big UN institutions and bodies such as the International Criminal Court, they're fraught with difficulties and are inherently political organisations. But I'm very much a believer in one step at a time, and I think this is a significant step in the right direction. And what it does is, for those who are suffering or enduring starvation or famine or conflict-induced hunger of the likes that we are seeing and the magnitude of which we're seeing now, I think it is a first step in recognising that this is an offence, it's a crime. And I think what we've seen historically, and our partner organisation, the World Peace Foundation, who Alex Duvall, who authored that report, put it very well, in that those who die of starvation and conflict are very much treated as second-class victims. So the record of fact is different. If you die through violent means, it's much more easy to be recognised. Those who are dying from a multitude of starvation-related complications, diseases, cholera is a big one, particularly in Yemen, they don't tend to fall within the crime count. And I think what this landmark resolution does, and what the project we're seeking to do in terms of advocacy on this, is recognising that these should fall within that definition and they should be counted, and that their plight should be recognised, and the situation should become so morally toxic that people recognise the criminality behind it.
Do you not worry that, like many war atrocities, the only people who are going to be held accountable for them are the losers in any given conflict, that the victors themselves escape scot-free?
I think it's a very good point, Rosalind. And I think it goes back a little bit to my last point, in that something is better than nothing. And it is international criminal law, it's evolving. It's a new justice system, and it's one that has, like all justice systems, its flaws. We see dealing with them on the international level are usually charged with those most responsible. But of course, the lower level perpetrators, from checkpoint officials to security officials in detention camps, they have a role to play as well. And I think it's interesting to see how this will develop.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and recommend us to a friend.